Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Welcome to Talking Business, a podcast produced in Melbourne, Australia. The podcast is available on the Acast site, my own website, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. Or you can get it at the Business Acumen website at www.businessacumen.biz or a banking day. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from my website, leongettler.com. I am Leon Gettler. My job is to review and monitor the week's news in business, finance and economics. I bring it all to you every week. This is episode number 2 in our series for 2024, and today's date is Friday, February the 9th. So today I'll be talking to Ron Weinberger, MD and CEO of ASX-listed M-Vision, a homegrown medtech company that has developed portable imaging technology to revolutionise stroke diagnosis and care for Australian patients. And I'm talking to AMP Capital Chief Economist Shane Ulver about the market and economy in 2024. But first, let's talk to Ron Weinberger.
Ron, tell us about M-Vision.
So we are, or M-Vision is an ASX-listed company. We're developing portable imaging devices, specifically at this stage for the identification and classification of stroke. So it's a fast, reliable, safe, cost-effective point-of-care way of actually looking at patients with brain injury. So it's not just stroke that we can look at. We can look at brain injury in general, but we are really starting on stroke because of the huge, I guess, unmet need and health economic burden around the world. So the device is like a small portable cart device. And why are we looking at stroke? And then aside from the fact that it's a really big health economic burden, one of the real issues is that there isn't any other way by the bedside or in the driveway of a home that you can actually look at a patient's brain in a portable way. So the only way to look at the brain today is with large devices like CT or MRI.
How long did it take them to develop the technology for M Division?
So the University of Queensland has been working on this for 10 years. So there's been, the company has been spun out of UniQuest to entrepreneurial colleagues. And we've really, since we've taken it out of the bench and turned it into a device that can go onto patients, it's taken 2 years. So we've accelerated very rapidly from the work that was done in a laboratory to the work that we've been able to do as a commercial entity.
Now, is the University of Queensland still involved?
Yeah, the University of Queensland is a shareholder. So that's number one. And secondly, we still have a strong relationship with the University of Queensland. One of the key inventors, Professor Stuart Crozier, now works as our Chief Scientific Officer. And he was involved originally in developing IP for correcting magnetic field distortions in MRIs. So essentially 60% of MRIs have his technology inside them. But he remains as one of our... as our Chief Scientific Officer, and we still retain a relationship with the scientists there.
And so how does that work? I mean, with the commercial organisation working with the university, how do you handle issues around that?
Yeah, it's always challenging to manage. One of the most important things is that you want to be able to control your own destiny and not always be in the hands of another party as a commercial entity. You want to look after shareholders' interests. But I think the way that we've done it is by having really good funding from the Australian government. So we've received a $2.6 million grant CRCP grant, Oz Industry with GE Healthcare, Federal Government, University of Queensland and Princess Alexandra Hospital. And that funding has allowed us, and the contract has allowed us to actually be well aligned in our goals and ambitions.
Oh, that would help you work very closely with the university and while attending to all the obvious issues, all the obvious governance issues around that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have another issue is that our location for our product development team is here in Sydney, and we have the relationship with the University of Queensland in Queensland. So that adds a geographical tyranny of distance, as well as just, you know, having a slightly different mindset as to how to approach a commercial problem to solve. But I think it's a real testament to the quality of the relationship that we have with the university that through all of these sorts of challenges, we've been able to be very effective in achieving our goals to date.
That's fascinating. Now, how are you actually commercializing products?
So we're commercializing the product by developing our own in-house product development, product development, technical and manufacturing team. So we're at Macquarie Park. We're in the process of we've just built our first generation device. And what we're doing now is actually taking that through into the clinical theatre to expand the testing that we've already done in our earlier prototype. So we're commercialising it by also working very closely with potential partners, such as the large imaging companies, which you'd be familiar with. Some of the names such as GE and Siemens in terms of getting their, support for what it is that we're looking to achieve.
So where are you drawing your members of your team
from? Pretty much globally. In fact, many of our team have come from all over the world, but some of them are local from New South Wales. We will be having some people from Queensland, from the university come to join us. But it's pretty much an international team.
So how many on the team?
We've got about 20 engineers at the moment, but that's expanding, and we're growing the team as we speak.
Now, how important was the listing?
The listing was really important because, you know, we want patient capital and access to capital markets, and the listing allowed us to have incredible investors. And if you actually have a look at our share price, you can see the patience of our investors, but also the fact that we've achieved our milestones along the way. So it really allows us to, as I said, to get access to that capital, but also keeps us as a company on our toes. We need to make shareholders happy, and that's a very important part of what we try and do.
Well, did the listing actually change the company?
It did in the way that it operated. It brought a new level of structure to the way that it operates. The governance and transparency that's required in a listed environment actually brings a level of functionality that you wouldn't normally have to have in a business, which you can look at it as a burden. In our case, I think it's been very much as a plus.
But you've managed to integrate that with the rest of the business quite successfully.
Yeah, we're still a small company. You mentioned earlier around governance issues and management. And I think working in a listed environment allows you to manage your governance issues with research institutions and all other third parties that you might be working with. So it actually provides a discipline that is, I think, a positive thing for our company at least.
Well, that's quite interesting because I'm wondering whether you've had to change any of the management structure with a listing to get it all hunky-dory.
Yeah, well, what we needed to do is to have the right people on the board. We needed to make sure that we had finance and audit committee. We had nominations and remuneration committee members and the right people to actually do that role. So from a board level, we've been very fortunate to have a very strong board and an independent board. From a management perspective, it's not been that much different to a private unlisted company.
So what's next for the business?
Well, next for the business is we're moving our first generation device into our full testing. So we have to go through a range of testing, of regulatory testing, validation and verification, it's called. So we need to take it through that. and then move it into the larger clinical trials where we're going to change the face of stroke diagnosis and imaging. We're going to be able to provide a clinical solution to a problem that isn't solved or met yet.
I'd imagine you'd be working quite closely with hospitals and clinics and doctors.
Yeah, absolutely. We work very closely with Princess Alexandra Hospital in Queensland. They've been our clinical partner to date. We're also work very closely with the Australian Stroke Alliance in Melbourne at a Royal Melbourne Hospital. And they've just recently received $40 million of the Medical Research Future Fund, of which we received a stage-gated $8 million of funding. And it's led by Jeff Donnan and Steve Davies, two of the most prominent stroke neurologists in the country and former presidents of the World Stroke Organization. And we're working closely with them to help drive our ambulance version, our Generation 2 device, into the market.
Well, Ron, that all sounds quite promising, and more strength to your arm. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. And thank you, Leon.
And now let's talk to AMP Capital Chief Economist Shane Oliver.
How's the market going to be performing in 2024?
Look, to be honest with you, I think we're going to see okay returns, but it's probably going to be a more constrained and volatile ride than we saw in 2023. 2023, don't forget, turned out to be pretty good. Now, Aussie shares returned something like 12.5% if you added the franking credits, you know, add 1% to that. So, and the market managed a capital gain of almost 8%. So, yeah, pretty good return overall. And of course, global shares earned in excess of 20%. There were a few bumps along the way, worries about recession. There was a lot of nervousness at the start of 2023. Recession worries, you know, issues in the Middle East later in the year, worries about inflation, interest rates, and so on. But despite that, it turned out okay. And the main factor there was that we saw inflation come down. And I think that's going to be a big factor as we go through the year ahead. We're going to see more good news on inflation, not in a straight line. There's going to be a few bumps along the way that'll cause volatility. But ultimately, that will enable lower interest rates, which will support share markets to provide another year of positive returns. That said, though, there's still a risk that we could have a recession. Growth is still slowing down generally around the world. Some parts, US, a bit stronger than expected, Europe a bit weaker. Uncertainties about China, particularly their property sector, and obviously geopolitical tensions and issues in the Middle East, and also with the presidential election later in the year. So all of those things are going to cause volatility. But ultimately, I think lower interest rates and the likelihood that that will spur reasonable growth as we go into 2025 will spur share markets into providing okay returns. So we're looking for the Aussie share market probably to get up to 7,900 or thereabouts, which is about 4% capital growth on where it ended 2023.
And so where do you see inflation finishing the year at?
Like, I think it's heading down. I think in Australia, we're probably going to be at around 3% by the end of the year, possibly just below that. That's actually a slightly faster decline than the RBA is allowing for. We have seen goods price inflation slow. There's issues in the Red Sea and port disputes in Australia and all these sorts of things are still floating around. But I think ultimately, as growth slows and inflationary pressures ease, you'll see inflation come down further. And in other parts of the world, in Europe and the US, you're probably looking at around 2% by the end of the year. So quite an ongoing downtrend in inflation. The last little bit, if you go globally, look at the global numbers at present in the US and Europe, they're around 3% in both parts of the world. The last little bit, the move from 3% to 2% might be a little bit slower because you're sort of squeezing services inflation out of the system. But I think that will occur. And by the end of the year, inflation will be back around targets. And of course, anticipation of that will enable central banks, probably starting with the ECB, but it could be the Fed starting to cut rates probably in the June quarter. I think the first one to move will be the ECB in April. Can't rule out cuts in March, possibly, but I think more likely in the June quarter with significant cuts, I think, in the US and Europe and then eventually UK and Canada. And then Australia also starting probably around the middle of the year, but less significant cuts in Australia because we haven't gone up as much as those other countries.
So you would expect some cuts in Australia by about June?
That's right. We're expecting the RBA to start cutting in June, and we see 3.25% rate cuts this year. Now, of course, many might listen to this and say, well, you know, in June, inflation will still be above the target. It probably will be. You know, you probably inflation by June of around 3.5%, 3.7%. So still above target on an annual basis, but I think the RBA will look at a couple of things. One is we're going to see a softer labour market by then. That'll start to take pressure off wages growth. And the monthly, now we get these monthly inflation numbers or quarterly inflation numbers, will be consistent with a continued loss of momentum in inflation. And so that, you know, the more near-term data will tell them that we're heading back to target, enabling them to start easing around June. Now, of course, there is a risk that it could come a couple of months later. Don't forget there's less RBA meetings now. There's less opportunities to review it by the RBA. So there's no meeting in July. If they miss out on June, then they'll wait till August, which they could well do. There's been some changes to the tax cuts in Australia, which direct more of those tax cuts to low and middle income earners. And an obvious risk of that is that it leads to more spending in the economy, which could be equivalent to a rate cut. So it could delay RBA rate cuts. So that's certainly a risk. But we think by the middle of the year, the RBA will start cutting rates with three cuts, 3.25% cuts this year, taking the cash rate to 3.6% by the end of the year.
But the issue too is that the rate cuts won't come in till July.
Well, yeah, if they start cutting their cuts, the cuts will occur in, RBA might start moving, but an argument could be on the part of the RBA, well, we've got these tax cuts starting in July, let's wait and see what the impact of them is. And that's a possibility which could cause them to delay. So I can see there is a risk there that June rate cuts, the start of rate cuts in June, might be too early by the RBA, particularly given the tax cuts that are starting in July. But I think putting that aside, you know, they've been forewarned of these tax cuts for a long time, so they're not new. They've rejigged them a little bit, but the overall quantum is still the same. So I think the more likely scenario is they still go in June, but and will take more of their guidance from the ongoing flow of economic data and inflation figures up until June.
One of the issues, and this has come up the last 3 years, 4 years, we had COVID, we had Ukraine influencing markets, and now we've got the Houthis firing missiles and disrupting shipping in the Red Sea. That could potentially affect shipping and inflation, couldn't it?
It certainly could, and it's another supply-side risk, which has been an issue for some time now, coming out of the pandemic. We had the disruptions to production as a result of the pandemic that added to inflation. Then there was the war in Ukraine, which affected commodity prices, particularly oil. And, yeah, it seems to keep going on. You get one supply shock after another. So that's certainly a risk. So far, the rising container costs has reversed a big chunk of the fall that occurred in the prior couple of years after adjustment from the pandemic, but they're still below their pandemic highs. So I suspect a short-term disruption there, but once things settle down, and I think that ultimately the US and their allies will get the Red Sea working again. It's obviously taking a few weeks to do so, but I think that that will ultimately happen, and therefore any impact will be relatively short-term. But yes, it does pose a short-term risk to markets. Got to put it in context, though. I think the broader supply shock issues coming in the pandemic was that the goods just weren't available. They weren't being produced. The ships weren't even operating. The containers had gone missing and so on. So it's a very different situation. This, I think, is more like a shorter term disruption and potential cost increase, but it's not anywhere near of the order that we were seeing coming out of the pandemic.
Which are the sectors that you see doing particularly well in the market?
I think you probably... I'm not so sure about the first half, because I think the first half of the year will probably be volatile, but through the year as a whole, I'd probably lean towards cyclicals and interest-sensitive stocks, because they will benefit from lower interest rates, which benefits ultimately stocks like REITs. You've got to be careful of office REITs, though, because of the ongoing write-downs there, but REITs generally probably do okay. Telco, utilities, so interest-sensitive as interest rates come down, but also cyclicals. You know, industrials will probably do okay. Eventually, consumer discretionary might do okay as investors start to anticipate a pick-up in consumer spending in 2025, but I'd be a little bit cautious on that in the near term.
So you don't see retail stocks doing that spectacularly well?
Through the year as a whole, probably not, because I think retailing will be under pressure. But I suspect there will be an opportunity there sometime in the next...
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
6 months in retail stocks as investors realise we've seen the worst, and as interest rates come down, that will hold out the promise of better conditions for retailing or consumer spending as we go into 2025.
Okay, so you see a challenging year ahead?
Yeah, I think it'll be more challenging than we saw last year. 2023, mind you, did see a few challenges out there and people were very nervous about things, but turned out okay. But the biggest falls in markets were around a 10% correction from the July highs to the October lows. Globally, that's in the US and Europe. In Australia, it was a bit less than 10%. So that's relatively mild. This year, I think we'll probably see a bit more volatility, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if some of that volatility kicks in the first half, you know, particularly around February, March. We've seen a great rally in markets into the end of 2023. We saw a bit of a pause at the start of 2024. Now markets are sort of pushing on again. US share market at record highs, yeah, running a risk here that your markets get a bit overextended, sentiment levels are quite high. That could set us up for a bit of a pullback into February, March, particularly if investors start worrying about inflation or central banks maybe delay cutting interest rates relative to what investors were expecting, or geopolitical issues come to the fore again, you know, perhaps those issues with the Red Sea and Middle East. So I think this will be a more volatile year and a somewhat more constrained year than we saw in 2024. But ultimately, lower interest rates will help markets into year end and provide okay returns, just not quite as strong as they were in 2023.
Well, Shane, thank you so much for your time again.
Thanks, Leon. My pleasure.
So what's happening in the news? Well, Australia's central bank kept interest rates unchanged at its first meeting of a revamped policy schedule and signalled further tightening remains possible. The Reserve Bank maintained its cash rate over a 12-year high of 4.35%, as predicted by economists on Tuesday. The path of interest rates that will best ensure that inflation returns to target in a reasonable timeframe will depend upon the data and the evolving assessment of risks, the RBA said in its post-meeting statement. Further increase in interest rates cannot be ruled out. The RBA also released its quarterly forecast, which showed inflation will only hit the midpoint of its 2-3% target band in 2026. What we need to be convinced is that inflation has moved enough, and we need to be convinced that it is going to get there and be sustainably staying there, said Reserve Bank Governor Michelle Bullock. We've made good progress, but there is more work to be done. The job is not done. The RBA board warned that there was a high level of uncertainty around the outlook for the Chinese economy, the consequences of the conflict in Ukraine and the Middle East, and how those made an impact on Australia's economy. It said further increases in interest rates couldn't be ruled out, and the board would continue to pay close attention to developments in the global economy, trends in domestic demand, and the outlook for inflation in the labour market. The measure, which smooths volatile items, came in at 4.2% in the final 3 months of 2023. The extended timeframe for inflation to return to target suggests the RBA will stick to its view that rates need to remain at elevated levels for some time, according to money markets and economists. That suggests Australia may be one of the last dollar block economies to begin easing, they said. At the same time, Australia's labour market remains solid and the economy has shown resilience to higher borrowing costs, suggesting there's no urgency to shift quickly to easing. Moreover, policymakers won't want to further fuel house prices that have been driven up by supply shortage and high immigration. And Ross McEwan will depart the National Australia Bank as CEO in April and be replaced by Andrew Irvine, currently head of its business bank. NAB said Mr. McEwan would retire from executive roles and pass a baton to Mr. Irvine, a British-Canadian dual citizen who's been NAB Group Executive for Business and Private Banking since 2020. And the Coalition will make Labor work for its tax backflip by proposing a raft of amendments to reflect the spirit of the stage two tax cuts and supporting the Greens' call for a Senate inquiry, while Anthony Albanese indicated he was keen for a fight. As the first published poll since the broken promise showed Labor had so far emerged unscathed but unrewarded, the Shadow Cabinet met to discuss tactics for the parliamentary battle, which began on Tuesday when Treasurer Jim Chalmers introduced legislation for the revamped tax cuts. Under Stage 3 from July the 1st, incomes between $45,000 and $200,000 will be taxed at 30%, and incomes above $200,000 will be taxed at 45%. Under Labor's changes, incomes between $18,200 and $45,000 will be taxed at 16%, down from 19%. The 30% tax rate will apply on incomes between $45,000 and $135,000, and then a 37% rate, which was abolished by Stage 3, will apply between $135,000 and $190,000. Above that, the 45% rate will apply. The reintroduction of the 37% rate will result in an extra $28 billion in bracket creep being collected over the next decade. The revamp will pass Parliament with or without the Coalition, and on Monday night, Shadow Cabinet discussed moving amendments that would reflect the spirit of Stage 3 without taking away any of the benefits for lower income earners. Sound acknowledged these amendments would not be adopted. The Coalition is then likely to wave through the legislation rather than vote against it and give Labor a fresh attack line. The Coalition will not go to the next election pledging to roll back Labor's tax package. The news poll published in The Australian found, while there was majority support for the broken promise, the key numbers had not shifted, and Labor still led the Coalition on a two-party preferred basis by 52% to 48%. Commutes, four-wheel drives and other light commercial vehicles could be phased or priced out of the market before there are genuine low-emission or electric alternatives, motoring groups have warned. They expressed concern on Sunday after the federal government unveiled details of its long-awaited vehicle efficiency standards, which mandate that all categories of new cars must reduce emissions by more than 60% by the end of the decade. From January the 1st next year, car makers will be forced to sell more electric and fuel-efficient vehicles into the Australian market or face financial penalties. The standard, which Climate Change and Energy Minister Chris Bowen said would bring Australia into line with all other developed nations, would subject manufacturers to an overall emissions cap that their vehicles could collectively produce. Labor says the new rules will save motorists about $1,000 a year in average fuel costs by 2028, but the opposition, while not ruling out supporting the policy, claims it could make utes unaffordable. The cap will be lowered each year, effectively adding as a carbon price in that it will force the increased manufacture of cleaner vehicles and the phasing out of more polluting petrol and diesel cars. Under the model to be pursued by the government, passenger vehicles and SUVs, as well as the heavier category of utes, vans and large pickups, will have to reduce their emissions by more than 60% between 2025 and the end of the decade, at an annual average reduction of more than 12%. Based on vehicle emissions data for 2023 for the top-selling vehicles, emissions from utes and vans will have to fall 10.3% just to reach the 2025 starting point, before dropping another 62% by 2030. Emissions from lighter cars will have to fall 6% before dropping another 61%. While the government contends that vehicle emission standards, which will only apply to new vehicles, will not affect the price or supply of diesel utes and four-wheel drives, for example, the industry fears the changes could be too vast. It predicts that manufacturers could charge more for the polluting cars so they can sell the cleaner cars more cheaply. And that there will soon be fewer petrol and diesel cars on the market, meaning for those who need them for work or lifestyle, they'll be more expensive. There are also significant doubts that the January 1st, 2025 start date could be met, due to the need to establish a regulator and the fact that car makers will not have the capacity to alter export patterns so quickly. Now, a PwC partner, the firm incorrectly publicly linked to its tax leak scandal, is planning to sue it for defamation after mediation talks between the parties fell apart. Richard Gregg, who successfully sued the firm last year for failing to follow a proper process in its attempt to fire him, is likely to seek compensatory damages from PwC if he makes a new legal move. Mr. Gregg was obliged to go into confidential mediation with the firm following his court victory, but this process has been unsuccessful. He's now in the final stages of weighing the new legal action that would target public statements made by the firm last year that implied he was associated with the PwC tax leak scandal. Two other former partners recently sued the firm for lost income. PwC partners earn more than $930,000 on average, according to data provided to the Senate last year. The new case, if it goes ahead, would bring yet more unwelcome publicity to PwC as it seeks to rebuild its public standing following the leaks matter. It may also serve to encourage other former or current partners to take the once inconceivable step of using the courts to resolve conflicts with the firm. The PwC tax leaks matter involved a former tax partner sharing secret government information within the firm that was then used to develop structures to sidestep new laws he was helping to develop. The scandal has rocked PwC's Australian operation and led to unprecedented scrutiny of the consulting sector. Mr. Gregg's case stems from when PwC, in response to the tax leaks matter, named him as one of eight partners who had left or were in the process of being removed from the firm's partnership related to the tax leaks affair. The firm alleged these partners had either been involved in the scandal or had not adequately addressed it. However, the firm's attempt to remove Mr. Gregg actually stemmed from conduct in 2021, which he had already been disciplined over, which was unrelated to the tax leaks. Mr. Gregg argued that PwC did not give him enough information or valid reasons for firing him as required by the firm's partnership agreement. In August, New South Wales Supreme Court Justice David Hammarskjöld found in Mr. Gregg's favour, ruling that PwC had not properly detailed the allegations used to force him out or provided him with a fair opportunity to respond to the complaints. Mr. Gregg's legal representative, Rebecca Giles, has since filed a costs order against PwC for more than $290,000 related to his initial court victory. PwC declined to comment on the case. And renewable energy developers are facing a new rating system to weed out cowboys from the industry after an independent report found their multi-billion dollar projects were creating anxiety and mistrust in rural communities. Australia has set aggressive targets to develop renewable energy generation sources to meet emissions reduction targets, which has led to a gold rush style wave of developers moving into communities. Energy Infrastructure Commissioner Andrew Dyer said the energy transition had the potential to be lucrative for farmers and landowners, but he warned the practices of prospective developers had sowed deep mistrust and the government would need to act to repair the industry's standing. The Community Engagement Review, investigating the impact of renewable projects and infrastructure on landowners, was renounced by Climate Change and Energy Minister Chris Bowen on July the 4th last year. Mr. Dyer concluded that transmission lines were a particular bone of contention among landowners. Australia must build about 10,000 kilometres of high-voltage power lines by 2050, and developers are searching for potential new developments to connect them. Mr. Dyer said the rush of development was damaging. The report found many landowners had been approached by multiple developers, and each had asked for permission to enter properties to scope the potential of new zero-emissions projects. Mr. Dyer said transmission lines would unlock employment opportunities for regional Australia and new investment in communities, but the industry must first improve its reputation. The report concluded Labor and state governments would need to plan better who is responsible for new developments while recommending a new rating system for developers to demonstrate their previous work on similar projects along with a proper complaint system. Mr. Bowen said the government had provisionally accepted all the recommendations. And the deputy chair of the corporate regulator has warned the financial sector may not have learnt the lessons of the landmark Hayne Royal Commission, noting many companies continue to make similar mistakes in dealing with customers. Sarah Court, speaking on the five-year anniversary of the Royal Commission into misconduct in the banking and superannuation financial services industry, said too often financial firms were facing the consequences of underinvestment in back-end systems. Ms. Court said the Australian Securities Investment Commission was not seeing a lot of red flags, but noted it had seen a number of recent matters marked by poor customer impacts and system failures that were not given enough attention. They were issues that could have been fixed or escalated, she said. Ms. Court said the financial system had been squarely on notice in the wake of the Royal Commission. The 2018 Royal Commission, run by former High Court Judge Kenneth Hayne, saw a number of changes made to Australia's regulatory landscape. Mr. Hayne handed his report to the Morrison government, with 76 recommendations to reform the financial sector. But then Treasurer Josh Frydenberg did not release the government's report until days later. The report made a number of recommendations, including a push for ASIC to take more companies to court for wrongdoing rather than striking settlement deals. Mr. Hayne's report made 13 referrals for ASIC to investigate, as well as examining a number of other case studies, of which 32 led to investigation. ASIC data shows it extracted $79 million in penalties tied to the 13 referrals, with one still before the courts. The regulator also fined the 32 case study companies $97.47 million. Ms. Court said it was chalk and cheese between how ASIC approached misconduct before and after the inquiry. The veteran regulator said Mr. Hayne showed his concern about ASIC's focus on consumer redress and remediation and its hesitancy to take court-based action. Ms. Court said ASIC had taken a cautious approach before the Royal Commission because it perceived the court-based action was expensive, took a long time, and the outcomes were uncertain. And former Productivity Commission Chair Michael Brennan says we can afford to be pretty bullish about the potential for AI to return productivity growth to the exceptional rates seen in the 1990s. Now running the economic research think tank E61 Institute, Mr. Brennan is optimistic about the impact of AI on the nation's growing services economy, which has traditionally been difficult to automate.
AI is a technology that is potentially highly effective at replacing tasks right through the services value chain, he said. Lawyers, accountants, doctors, all manners of professionals will be able to get rid of some menial tasks and focus much more on the high value added things. Another compelling reason for optimism, he said, is that we are now seeing not just new technology, but the complementary re-engineering of business processes that change the way you fundamentally do something. Mr. Brennan backed the move by Labor to direct the Commission's work more tightly through a statement of expectations, the first in the independent body's 25-year history. Treasurer Jim Chalmers delivered the statement as new chair. Danielle Wood took up the job last November, saying the Commission had to sharpen its focus, draw on a broader range of view, and diversify its skills base. And investors hoping for a quick resolution to the country's most talk about merger, the mooted combination of Woodside Energy and Santos, will be forced to wait longer to find out where it will go, with due diligence extended by weeks. If it proceeds, a deal would create a global liquefied natural gas powerhouse with 16 million tonnes of annual capacity and operations stretching from Australia and Papua New Guinea to the United States. The discussions about a merger had been scheduled to wind up on Friday. This is no longer on the cards. There are plenty of issues to work through before any proposal can be put together. For a start, there are several approval hurdles to be met at Woodside's $16.5 billion Scarborough gas project in West Australia and Santos's Barossa development in the Northern Territory, both favoured targets for legal action by environmentalists. The Scarborough project, for example, will take up 28% of the combined group once it's off the ground, according to analysis by UBS, but holds considerable commercial risk as it estimates less than 30% of reserves are currently contracted. It says merging may help diversify commercial risk away from the project level and help ensure Scarborough Gas is not sold at a discount to other Asian-based LNG suppliers. And almost after 40 years of slinging cheap pizza, pasta and gelato to hordes of hungry families in Melbourne's inner north, the birthplace of one of Melbourne's most recognisable restaurant chains will close its doors to the public this weekend for good. Taken over in 1985 by Rocky Pantaleo and fellow Italian immigrant Felice Nagna, the Rathdown Street La Porchetta restaurant launched hundreds of franchise outlets around the country in the following decades. The enormous Rathdown Street restaurant is unmissable with its hand-painted signage, Pizza No. 1 in Australia, across the three-store frontage, which in recent times has been covered in graffiti. Inside, the ceilings and walls are plastered with photographs of family members, customers and celebrities, while Vespa motorcycles and other Italian memorabilia hang from the ceiling. The Pantaleo family members, Natalina and Azzurra, took to social media on Monday to announce the closure of the flagship restaurant. "We'd like to inform you all that the original family would be moving on and closing the doors," they said in the post, announcing February the 11th would be the final day of trading. The La Porchetta name boasted at least 80 franchised outlets in Australia, New Zealand and Indonesia in 2010. Today, there are almost 30 La Porchetta restaurants in Victoria, three in Queensland, one in New South Wales, and four in New Zealand, according to the company's website. And it's the beginning of the profit reporting season. Myer said it expects net profit of between $49 million and $53 million for the 6 months to January 27, which includes the unfavourable impacts of store closures and the impact of inflationary cost pressures. The forecast is well down on the interim profit of $65 million Myer posted in 2023, which was at the time its highest interim profit since 2014. Nick Scali posted a 39% fall in profit to the $43 million for the 6 months of December. Amcor's net profit slipped to US$286 million from US$691 million a year earlier. Luxury goods marketplace Setai's statutory gross profit increased in the half to $82.2 million from $47 million a year ago. And Bunnings landlord BWP Trust's net profit for the period was $53.2 million compared to $111.3 million in 2022. And that's it for this week. And next week I'll be talking to Nina Webster, the Managing Director of Vidimerix, a clinical stage biopharmaceutical company with a portfolio of drug candidates for inflammatory diseases, including kidney and respiratory diseases. And I'll be talking to ComSec Chief Economist Craig James about what's in the market for the week ahead. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from our website, leongetler.com. If you like Talking Business, please leave us a review with Apple Podcasts. Thank you in advance. In the meantime, you can catch me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn and YouTube. If you want to contact me, email me at leon@leongetler.com. I answer all emails. Wishing you all a safe and healthy week and looking forward to bringing Talking Business next week.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues. your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.